did I get here? And now here is your host, Unmaudy.
Yeah, that's right. The computer voice is right. My name is Johnny Gowdy. This is episode 17 of How Did I Get Here? I think I might buy an ice cream sandwich from this ice cream guy while I do this intro. So it's been a pretty crazy week. I had a birthday. Skyrocket played. Can you turn off the music? All right. So Skyrocket played. It was a pretty exciting time there. Hi. I want to get some ice cream. Here. I'd like to get a. Can I get one of those Screamers cookies and cream?
Yes, sir.
Anyway, I had a birthday, and I played out of town, spent some time with my family on Saturday, which was nice. I had a nice Italian dinner with my friend Kyle and my friend Jake. And then there was a, thank you, there was a crazy episode of 48 Hours, thank you, focusing on a part of my life. I literally just bought ice cream while podcasting. I'm like a ice cream buying podcaster. Anyway, there was this crazy episode of 48 Hours. I watched it when I got home from Houston. It was very intense to see your life kind of put in that way. And I got a lot of feedback from people I knew and from people I didn't know. A lot of very nice things were said. It was really nice. But on that show, and so thank you to everyone that said nice things and saw the band on there and liked my band Liars and Saints. Anyway, I just wanted to thank everyone that reached out. And people I knew, family, people I didn't know that reached out and said nice things about that show. I'm glad that part of my life is over. I'm glad that episode is aired and gone. It will repeat, I'm sure. But anyway, just thank you. And those of you who like Liars and Saints, thank you very much. You can hear our music on Bandcamp.com and buy it there as well. And we will be playing in Austin on Thursday, October 20th at Club DeVille at 9:30. Episode 17. I can't believe there have been so many already. My guest is John D. Graham. He's an extremely accomplished and great singer-songwriter. He came by today. We sat down and talked about the Skunks, the True Believers, his solo career, what he did as a sideman in Los Angeles with John Doe and Michelle Schacht, many people like this. Guy's amazing. Great conversationalist. He has a documentary that's out about him. We also talk about that. You can find out about him at johndgraham.com. And so I guess I'll stop yapping. Thank you for being outside with me. It's a gorgeous day in Austin, Texas. And here's my conversation with John D. Graham.
Nos vemos, venceremos.
It's like there used to be a public television show when I was a kid called Vegetable Soup.
Yeah,
reminds me of vegetable soup because they always mix the Spanish and the English.
Right. I was going for sort of a Sabado Gigante, Johnny Canales.
Johnny Canales, Johnny, you got it.
You got it.
You got it.
You got it, man.
You got to have a catchphrase.
I played on Johnny Canales.
You did?
When I was in high school in Camado, Texas, I had the only rock band for 100 miles, and we got to play on Johnny Canales' Sabado Gigante.
Wow.
Yeah, 16.
Wow.
Yeah, it was.
Was that your first band?
That was, yeah, it was my high school rock band.
Tell me about this high school. Tell me about growing up in Camado.
Oh, it was crazy. I mean, it's the end of the earth. You know, I mean, you drive 157 miles southwest out of San Antonio until you run out of United States.
Right.
Then you make a left and go another 30 miles. And it was the frontier, you know? I mean, people talk about, you know, the narco wars going on the border. And the thing is, it was always going on down there. Yeah. It just moved up to a place where there's people, you know, and then everyone got all upset about it. But it was crazy. I mean, you didn't go down to the river, the Rio Grande. You didn't go down to the river at dark, not because of the illegals coming back and forth, because they're guys just like us, you know, looking for work. But the drug traffickers, this is in the 70s, you know. And there'd be a body turn up by the river once a week.
You know? Wow!
Yeah, it was a crazy place.
So how were you exposed to music down there?
That's the crazy thing, man. You know, no one in my family is a musician,
right?
And there's not really much outside influence down there.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna, not a lot of radio in the 70s down
but
there.
But like
either.
You, man. Didn't you know, like, from a pretty early age, this is what you wanted to do?
Kind of, yeah. Yeah. I knew I wanted to do something like this, and this was something that seemed, you know,
feasible.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Same thing. It's like, I played piano in church from 8 until 12, basically, because, you know, there was a very limited talent pool down there, and I could play piano. And I got my first guitar at 12, and started learning guitar with one of those Learn to Play Guitar with Mel Bay books.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I also had the Ventures record, Learn to Play Guitar with the Ventures, where one side of it was all the rhythm parts and the other side of it was all the lead parts.
Oh, wow.
And so you learned the parts and played along with the Ventures.
Right.
It was badass. But I just was obsessed with it. Like, once I got that guitar, I never put it down. That was all I did, you know? And it's not like there was anybody that I was watching and going, wow, that's what I want to do.
Right.
It just, I knew.
Did you see it as like a key to get out of Kamalo? Like to,
you know,
your freedom?
I knew I was going to get out.
It's going to get me.
Right, yeah. Right. I was going to get out one way or the other.
Right.
You know, my older brother was a honors student at UT and went on to be a doctor and is now actually a lieutenant colonel surgeon in the Air Force.
Wow.
And I watched him shoot out of there like a fucking rocket.
Yeah.
And that was my plan.
Yeah.
And so I went to UT, the same honors program he did. I got sidetracked fairly early on. Bit. But one way or the other, I was going to get out of there.
Well, did you go in there in the honors program under what? What was your major?
It was plan two, so you could only do pre-law or pre-med.
Okay.
And so I knew I didn't want to do pre-med, so I did pre-law and made it 2 years into their program. And then at that point, I was in that band, The Skunks, and we were getting a lot of really good openers. And we opened for The Clash one night, and that was the end.
Wow.
You know? Because, I mean, we actually ended up hanging out with them after the show. And I was up all night, and then I go into this seminar class the next morning. And I've got my books under my arm, and I sit down. It's like those terrace seats, like state auditorium seating. It was just like in the movies. Like
the paper chase.
Exactly. Yeah, the sound went and dwindled down to nothing. And then it was silence. And I'm looking around this room at all these kids. And I just went, oh, I don't belong here.
I need to follow those guys from last night.
Exactly. Yeah. What am I doing here? You know? And so that was it. That was the end. I mean, I always knew that I was going to play, I think, you know, because, I mean, what else? Why else did I spend all that time with the guitar? But I think I was trying to play by the rules. And you know, my parents we struggled really poor. And I got, you know, partial scholarship to UT. And, you know, I didn't want to disappoint anybody. I wanted to do the right thing. But,
dude, you know? Yeah.
There came a point where it's like,
I feigned a college career.
Right,
as well.
Exactly.
I know exactly what you're talking
about. Yeah, yeah. And at some point you go, oh, wait a minute. This is not just a waste of my time. This is a waste of their time, you know? So
So let's go back to the band that you had in high school. Were those cover songs you were playing?
We did a couple of covers, but it was all, mainly all originals.
What kind of music?
It was, you know what? The closest I can describe it to is like, I mean, I could say heavy rock. You know, like, as opposed to hard rock, it was heavy rock, which is sort of the stepping stone between hard rock and metal.
Right.
You know, this was 75.
Okay.
You know, so I would say like UFO.
Okay. Yeah.
We were like UFO.
Okay. Well, it's cool.
You know, oh, fuck. It was great, man. It was great. I played through it. played through an orange stack.
Nice.
Oh, it was.
Did you sing, or do you guys have another guy?
No,
singing?
I never sang. No. We had a guy older than me who was the main songwriter and singer, and I wrote stuff,
right.
You know, but like as became sort of my MO is I would write stuff and then hand it off,
right?
You know,
and then they'd finish it or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Or they would just sing it, you know. So, it was a blast though.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think of what. Well, of course we did Down by the River.
Right.
It went on for like 30 minutes.
Right.
You know, what else did we cover? Seems like. Oh, we did Funk 49.
There you go.
You know,
we did that in my current cover band.
Fantastic yeah. song.
Yeah.
One of the best song. Guitar riffs of all
totally.
Time.
Yeah.
And when it does the key change, it goes up to the wow.
Yeah.
It's satisfying playing that
it's
song.
Very satisfying.
I still will break out into it on stage occasionally because yeah. it's satisfying.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It's a great song. So then you came to Austin. How did the Skunks come together?
You know, that's a funny thing because they were already in existence. And I was living at a co-op, College House Co-op, up on 21st Street on campus. And it's funny because, you know, the whole punk thing was exploding.
Yeah.
And that was 77, 78.
It was really exploding here.
Literally. Yeah. I mean, just like... The Huns bust had just happened, and it was just like following this stuff in the paper. It was like it was a movement, and it really had nothing to do with English punk or even New York yep. punk.
Right.
It was its own thing. It was right. very quirky, very weird. A lot of stuff coming out of the RTF department, you know, at UT, where it was like people who were not musicians, who were not songwriters, who just went, I want to be a part of this,
yeah.
and would just pick up a guitar, never learn to tune it, but start playing and
right.
writing songs, you know. Just crazy, crazy amount of bands just sprang up overnight, you know.
Yeah.
And I was playing in a little band that was sort of like the house band at that co-op. And we played at Raoul's like maybe twice a month, something
right.
like that.
And Raoul's is like a big punk club.
Yeah, that was
Austin.
The only
yeah,
punk club
thing.
At that time.
Where was it?
That was where, what is it called?
It's near campus?
Yeah, it's you know where that 7-Eleven is at 29th?
Yep.
In between that 7-Eleven and the Pancake Place.
Okay.
It's like a little frat bar now.
Yeah.
And it was the only place that you could play.
Yeah.
There was a punk club in San Antonio and there. And then there was a club in Dallas called DJ's. That was it, you know. And all the other scenes were kind of taking their cues from us, you know. And at that point, I was still going to college. And I was playing in that little band called the Whippets that was like the house band. And that was almost all covers, but like... You know, the guy who sang in that band, Drew Schertz, taught me a whole bunch about deconstructing rock, you know, because I was coming from, like I said, the UFO country, you know, of like this weird blend, because of where I grew up, this weird blend of hard country, ranchero music,
yeah.
and hard rock.
Yeah.
And that was all, if you look at it, it's that same sort of dumb passion,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
which fits really well
yeah.
with punk rock. And so, anyway, he kind of started playing guitar with him just because I was a better guitar player than anybody else in the band.
Right.
And but he had to like gradually introduce. I'd never heard of the Stooges, you know. He really indoctrinated.
Well, how would you like? I mean, how did people? Cause,
exactly.
Like, I lived when that all that stuff broke in 77. I was like 8, 9 years old.
Yeah.
And I lived in a little town in Marin County called Nicasio, and we didn't get any. We didn't get any radio stations except one
God,
radio
this is just
station
like, where
that was like
I
an independent
yeah.
Yeah. College
yeah.
station that
right.
that played the Sex Pistols when they first came
right,
out.
Right, right.
And stuff like that. I heard that stuff. I don't remember ever hearing the Stooges, but I always wondered, like, how did that get out then? There was no internet. There was
no.
Those guys didn't really go on TV or anything.
No, they did. Towards the very, like, the end of 77, Don Kirchner's rock concert had a producer that was willing to go out on a limb for the rock stuff, and it was so shocking to most people that he got fired.
Yeah.
He had, the New York Dolls were on Don Kirchner's rock concert.
Right.
And it's really funny, because I had sort of heard about them because I would go to the local library, which took Rolling Stone as like part of a grant, I think they had to take to get other things. So I'd go to this local library and read Rolling Stone, and I'd read about the Dolls, and it's like they sounded like everything I would be interested in.
Right.
It was hard rocking, you know, down-to-earth lyrics, da-da-da-da. So I got together a bunch of my friends, and we're going to watch them when they were on Don Kirshner's rock concert. And so we're watching it, and it's midnight, and they come out, and they're all in drag, every one of them.
Right.
Like, nine and full-on, like, lipstick and stockings
right, right.
and the whole thing. I was real unpopular there for about a week.
I can imagine.
It blew people's yeah. minds. But, you know, there was no pipeline for that stuff.
No.
And particularly not, like, if you're talking about this little town you grew up in. Exactly.
I only
the
lived
same.
There for like a year, but that was when all that was happening.
And then
I moved to Houston, and I just never heard of that music again.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean,
well, there's people in Houston who still haven't heard
right,
of that music.
Right, right.
It's so funny, though, because... yet still, somehow, it got out, and in a huge way, you know? Although I think, I mean, there's you know, there's that certain sort of inflation of mythology, like like with the True Believers, you know, if everybody who claimed that they saw the True Believers had actually seen the True Believers, we'd still be a band, and we'd be
probably.
Rich, you know? People talk about... You know, they're like, oh, I remember when you played the Bowery Ballroom in New York. And it's like, what, were you four?
Yeah,
you know, there's
exactly.
no way. There's no way.
Right.
And I think there's some of that with the Stooges because, I mean, like, I was talking to Wayne Kramer about this stuff. And Wayne was like, we played to nobody.
Yeah.
Most of the time, we played to nobody with these, like, intermittent explosions of huge crowds that
right.
were never our crowds, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like, yet... You know, this is like you and I were talking about before the show. We think we know what's going on with the other musicians,
right.
but we don't. In
right.
my mind, Iggy and the Stooges were gods, you know.
Right.
Well, they were, but not by attendance,
right.
you know. So,
yeah.
I'm sorry, I got lost.
No,
I got excited
so
talking
we,
about
no, no,
that.
No, no, no. This is what we're here to do. So we could go to back to your you were about to get in the Skunks.
Oh, right. So what happened there was I was playing in that band, the Whippets, and we were playing some little party. We used to have a Friday afternoon happy hour there at the co-op, and meanwhile the Skunks were like kind of the band of the moment, right? They were really taking off, and they just opened for Patti Smith and Elvis Costello.
Wow.
And it was all in the papers, and it was a really big deal, and Patti Smith and Elvis came out and sat in with them, you know.
Oh, wow.
And there were photos of the Skunks with these guys. It was a big fucking deal.
Wow.
And their guitarist quit. Faz Eddie Munoz, he just quit, like, to go find his fortune in L.A. He ended up playing with the Plimsolls and a bunch of other people. And so they were fucked. They had no guitar player. And the guy who was sort of like their street man, you know, combination, you know, roadie, marketer, muscle, thug, you know.
Yeah.
This guy, Richard Luckett, who's still around and one of the original characters. He happened to be walking down the street and heard me playing with these guys and went, oh, that guy's pretty good. And he just went up and, like, in the middle of a song, came up and was like, hey, you come here. And I was like, what? And he was, like, wearing creepers and had, you know, the sidewall haircut and the whole thing. And it's like, wow, what's going on here? And he was like, why don't you come audition for this band? And so in my mind, what I said was, well, I'll go audition, but even if I get it, I'm not going to do it, you know.
Right.
And I went and I played and it was, I got goosebumps for like an hour the whole time I was playing with them. It was like, fuck, this is the very thing. This is the thing, you know?
Yeah.
And it was a great way for me to get into it because Jesse did all the writing, did all the singing.
Right.
It was a punk rock trio. All that was required was for me to just play the hell out of the guitar, you know? There was no slow songs. Everything was super fast. Everything was super loud. I had to go get a bigger amp.
Yeah.
You know, first time I'd ever gotten a gig where I had to get a bigger amp, you know?
Yeah.
And, man, I was in. And so we played for probably about a year doing some local stuff. And then we started getting these openers. And, like, we opened for the Ramones. And we opened for all at the old Armadillo, which was, man, it was a time. That was a time.
That was interesting because at that point it must have just been like a crazy hodgepodge, like such an eclectic thing, like the calendar must have looked insane because it was still Cosmic Cowboy time, and it was still
Man, that's the shit. Okay.
Van Halen played there,
dude.
You know,
the most beautiful thing about it, about the Armadillo was there was no dividing lines, and things just it was like a collision of about five different cultures.
Yeah,
and when we played with the Clash there. Which was probably the most exciting rock show I'd ever seen. You know, I mean, it was just
what year was that?
That was right after London Calling.
Oh, wow,
like wow. London Calling actually hadn't come out yet.
Okay,
and so they were playing stuff off London Calling, but nobody had heard it.
Right.
God, man, it was just. I mean, it was like having a nail driven in your forehead. It
yeah.
was. It was.
And
unbelievable.
Then they pretty much they didn't. Train in Vain was on there, right?
Yeah.
So then that was like.
That was right when they were going to explode.
Yeah.
You know, and anyway.
Get goosebumps just thinking about that.
Oh, man.
That's insane.
I got to tell you, this is just, I mean.
Yeah, please, tell me a story.
So, they're all backstage, and unlike a lot of bands from that period, they were all in one dressing room, like all of them hanging out together.
Yeah.
And like they did the whole circle before they went on, and they went on, and I was out front, and it's like looking across the crowd, there were like cowboy hats, mohawks and ponytails,
right,
all in the same crowd.
Yeah.
It was packed and no one knew what to expect.
Yeah.
And they came out, the stage lights went up white, just like white, hard white light. They took the stage like a fucking commando group. They all like ran out. Strummer grabs a microphone stand, and it's like a wooden stage, and counts it off by slamming the microphone stand down into the stage.
Oh, goes, that's so cool.
They went into London Calling.
Wow.
And I'm getting goosebumps just telling this story.
Jesus.
It was fucking unbelievable. I mean, it was like a perfect moment that went on for 5 minutes, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm looking around, and it's like seeing these ponytails, cowboy hats, and mohawks, and everybody is just jaw-dropped, you know?
Wow.
And that's one of the things that's missing in Austin now, I think.
Totally.
Is that wide-open...
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
Why not? You know?
Yeah.
And I mean, if you look at that bill for that night, it was us, Joey Ely's band, like
right.
the original Joey Ely band with the Maynes brothers
right.
and Jesse Ed Taylor playing guitar.
Yeah.
And oh my God. And then the Clash, you know, so you put those three things together. I mean, it was so over the top. I mean, I can't even describe it to you. You know, drugs weren't necessary.
Yeah.
It was something like that.
Yeah,
drugs
exactly.
weren't necessary, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, that's a really long answer to a question I don't even remember anymore.
We were just talking about how the Skunks got together, how
yeah.
you ended up in the Skunks. So you guys did a lot of opening shows. Alejandro ended up in that band?
No.
That was just you and Jesse.
Yeah, it was just me and Jesse. And then we went on the road, and basically the road meant Austin, New York, because it was really the only place. Where are you going to go for
right.
punk rock, you know? And we ended up living in New York for about 6 months, and it took its toll. It was just really hard.
It was a hard time in New York.
I don't even recognize New York now. I mean, my oldest boy, Roy, goes to NYU.
Oh, really?
And also, he grew up there pretty much. I mean, from like age 4 to 14.
Mm-hmm.
He was in New York, so he's back there. He considers it home. But I go there now, and I don't even recognize it.
No.
You know, I mean, it's like going to Disneyland.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
back then, I mean, you could die 50 different ways depending which direction you walked.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
And so anyway, it was a tough one. And when we came back for a break, I quit because I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't live out there. And then I like played. It's just a whole succession of kind of dumb gigs, and then.
Did you guys make any records or anything?
Yeah, they kept going after I left, and put out two records with the Murray Brothers.
Okay.
But the only record, there's two records of the Skunks that I'm on. The one is the single Earthquake Shake, which got tons of airplay all over because it came out at the right time, you know. Mm. And then the EP called Gimme Some, which also got a lot of play.
Okay.
So there's that. And then after the Skunks, there's like a whole, you know, series of gigs that I'm not proud of.
Did you take gigs, like, just to make a living and make
just,
ends meet?
I mean, basically what I did was because I'm a contrarian, I took, like, gigs that I shouldn't have, you know, just to sort of fuck with people. I played in a blues band, like, straight from punk rock into Lou Ann Barton. She'd just done a record with Jerry Wexler. Wow. And so I started playing guitar with her, and it pissed everyone off. Like, the punks were like, sell out, and the blues people were like, what the fuck?
Yeah, why is this punk guy up there?
Right. Yeah. Right, which, you know, in my opinion, punk rock was the blues of its day, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, Johnny Thunders was a blues man.
Yeah.
Like it or not, he was, you know? So then I kind of just got burned out because I was, at that point, I was like 24, 23, and I'd been playing nonstop since I was 18.
I love the burnout at 23.
Right,
you know, we
look
at ourselves now. Like, I remember times I was like, you know, 22 and like, you know what? I got to quit. This isn't going anywhere.
I remember turning 30 and going, wow, this is getting embarrassing.
Yeah.
You know, and now I'm 52. Yeah. And it's like, actually, I'm better than I ever was, you know?
So you did this gig with, how long did you do, like, with Lou Ann Barton?
That was about a year.
Wow.
About a year. And she toured a lot.
Yeah.
And then I was in a couple of other bands. And then one night I went to see... Alejandro had been in this band called Rank and File.
Right.
That I didn't care much for because it was like, actually it was the first cowpunk band there was. You know, they were like the kind of the beginning of the whole cowpunk thing. And it just seemed like a joke to me because I grew up on country music and this was like, I don't get this. Is it supposed to be ironic?
Right.
Or do they mean it?
Yeah.
Or, you know. They're wearing 10-gallon hats. That's kind of goofy, you know?
Yeah.
And he thought so, too. So Al had quit. And he was starting this band with his brother, Javier. And I went to see him at Clubfoot one night. And it was the first thing I'd seen since the Skunks that made me want to participate, you know?
Right.
Because what they had done is they stripped away all the fashion and all the pretense of the country thing or the cowpunk thing. And the roots were deeper and broader. You know, like the roots were more of some weird blend of American roots music and punk rock.
Right.
Like conflating the Byrds and Iggy Pop somehow.
Right? Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I know that's a hard mix to imagine, but that was what we listened to in the van. You know, we listened to Mott the Hoople and Bob Dylan.
Right.
And there was no, in our minds, there was no contradiction.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's hard to explain now because, honestly, Alejandro and Javier both were a lot smarter about music and culture than I was. You know, my main thing up to that point had been a guitar player. Now, I wrote songs, but the main thing I wanted to do was to play guitar. And those guys, I mean, Alejandro knows probably 300 songs, you know, I mean.
Right.
And Javier, the same thing. I mean, and they both had really deep roots in American music. You know, I mean, thing people don't realize about Javier is like he's like an encyclopedia of surf rock and instrumental rock, you know?
Right.
I mean, he knows all those obscure little garage bands. I mean, he could tell you what the third track is on any Nuggets album, you know?
Right, right.
I mean, just super into it. And I learned a lot from those guys. And they also, their standards were a lot higher than what I was used to, you know? And they talked about songs. They would talk about songs, you know, and so how that ended up happening was I would watch them. They were the only band I would go out and see, you know, and I think they knew who I was, and I knew obviously who they were, and they would see me out at their gigs, and we had some mutual friends, but I never talked to these guys. I would just go see them. They were the only band in town that I thought was doing anything interesting.
What year was that?
That would have been
80?
That would have been 84.
Okay.
83, actually, probably.
Okay.
And so one night, Alejandro came out to see me do something. I forget what it was. I was playing with somebody, and And he said, hey, listen, I understand that you play lap steel a little bit. And I'm like, yeah, I fooled with it. And he was like, come out and sit in with us at the Long Riders show. And so I came out and I sat in with him, and it was just a fucking riot. It was so much fun. I never had that much fun playing guitar, never.
Wow.
And because it was wide open and there were three guitar players, and it was just like a brawl. It was a guitar brawl,
yeah.
You know? And so after that show, he was like, hey, listen, we're doing this thing next week at the beach. Why don't you come out and sit in?
Right.
They never asked me to join the band. I just eventually was in the band by attrition, you know, because yeah. I kept coming out to sit in, and eventually I was on tour with them. And the thing that I owe the most to Alejandro and to Hav was that they were writing songs to get ready to do some recording, and they were like, do you have anything? And so I brought them these songs that I'd written, and they were like, wow, these are great. I go, okay, well, let me write out the lyrics for you. And they were like, why? And I'm like, so you can sing it. And they were like, no, you wrote it, you sing it.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I was made to stand up in front of the band and sing. Like, I had 3-4 songs a night, and I'd never done that, never, not once. And to this day, I mean, I can blame it on Al.
Yeah.
You know? And it was just a hell of a time, man. It was so exciting. It was a really fun thing to
And you guys all got along really well.
Was no, very, we fought no, constantly.
Yeah, it was one of those bands. Right?
It was one of those
yeah.
bands. Well, I mean, you have two brothers.
I know there's like almost like a legendary thing about your relationship with Alejandro.
Oh, God.
That I remember when I was first talking to someone about having you on, their eyes like twinkled, and they were like, you should have both of them on together. I was like, maybe that's something that we should do on its own.
Like, Halloween night.
Yeah, when I get more proficient at this job. So you guys fought constantly, creative, over everything.
Over everything.
Yeah.
And
passionate, young.
Absolutely. And believing 100% each of us was right.
Yeah.
You know, and, but at the same time, it was Band of Brothers, like yeah. 100%, you know, like anybody started anything with any one of us, you had the whole band to deal with. You
right.
know? And, which it's just, you know. Again, if we were as big as people say we were, we'd still be a band,
right.
you know. But we did some fucking trailblazing, you know. I mean, we toured.
What all do you guys? You guys went. You made this record that,
yeah.
that you guys were writing for,
right? We
and
made
what happened
record.
With that?
Very little.
Okay.
Did
you guys get signed?
Yeah, we got signed to EMI.
Right.
And then.
What? How long did that take? Like, what year did you guys?
You know what?
Record out in like
85
or 86 or something?
Yeah, 85. And when I think back about it, it doesn't seem like it was this big deal about trying to get signed. It seemed like we played locally until we knew what it was we were doing, and then Alejandro was like, "Well, we have to tour. It doesn't mean anything to just be a local band. We have to tour." And so we bought a van and we started touring. And I don't ever remember getting paid in those days.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So
I know.
It wasn't even, like, as long as you could afford, like, cigarettes and beer.
Exactly.
And a hamburger.
Exactly.
There's no reason to.
There's no
yeah,
reason to even
to
worry
complain.
About it,
yeah.
you know? And it was just very weird, like, almost like socialist thing about the money in the band.
Yeah.
Where it would be like, when you would go out on the road, the band covered everything.
Right.
From cigarettes to food. To, I don't even
yeah.
think I carried money, you know,
yeah.
back then.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were very driven.
Yeah.
You know? And,
so
and,
when
you, know,
you went out on tour, did you go out on tour on your own or were you, or
both.
Did your label put you on with?
Both. Yeah. We that's kind of where it took off for us was we did one tour that was just like 5 months. You know, this rotating thing. Frank Riley, who does High Road,
yeah.
had his own little book. We were the first major label band that Frank Riley booked.
Wow.
And so we did one that was 5 months long that just almost killed us. And we came off the road, and Alejandro knew David Hidalgo
uh-huh.
from Los Lobos.
Uh-huh.
And they had just put out How Will the Wolf Survive and had like this massive hit.
Right.
And then they said, come out with us. And so we toured for a year with Los Lobos.
Wow.
With opening stadiums, basically, you know, while they did How Will the Wolves Survive. And they just kept getting bigger and bigger. And so over the course of the year, you know, like they went from being in a crappy little bus to a nice bus to, you know, eventually we're playing. Like, I remember playing in Seattle at the SeaTac Auditorium, which was like their version back then of like the Dell Arena, you know.
Right.
I mean, it was fucking huge.
Yeah.
And that was kind of where we made our bones, I think, you know, was with Los Lobos. And that was just, it was just such a wild time. I mean, it was so great.
Did you guys have videos on MTV or anything?
Yeah.
You did?
My wife at the time, my first wife, Sally Norvell, and her friend Tamara, who went on to do Gun Crazy and a bunch of other movies, did a video for Hard Road. And it was, again, MTV was just sort of really taking off at that point.
Right.
And so we were on MTV all the time. It was crazy.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
That is crazy. So then after the Los Lobos tour, you guys came back and made another record?
We came back and made another record, fired the bass player, fired the drummer.
Yeah.
See that coming.
Yeah.
And made another record. And just as that record was being finished, we were actually mixing it. And we get notice that we've been dropped. And the record was pretty much done. I mean, it was being mixed.
Right.
And we were, it was devastating,
yeah.
You know, because this, and also the first record, I'll be honest, I never liked it. It was produced by Jim Dickinson, you know, who did The Replacements,
uh-huh.
And it's a piano player on Wild Horses, and it's an amazing American musical character, but he wasn't much of a producer, really. I didn't like it. And so the second record was fantastic. I mean, it was this huge rock record. Jeff Glicksman, who did Georgia Satellites.
Yeah.
And just fucking unbelievable rock record. And we just knew this was it. You know, this was it. There's no stopping us. And then they dropped us. And it was, EMI had like a purge, you know, and heads rolled. And so like we got dropped the same day as David Bowie, the Chili Peppers, somebody else really huge. Oh, Sting. Yeah, it was wild. Like, it was just a bloodbath. Like, everybody was gone. Our manager at the time was Joe Nick Petoskey, who's
a big writer here
in Texas. And he flew out to L.A. to try and do damage control. And literally, he went into EMI and he said it was nothing but empty desks. There was, like, no one there. And they had downsized, moved the thing, and that was it. So immediately, the word had already been out on this new record. And so Mercury called and said, we'll buy it, you know, for whatever y'all spent, we'll buy it. And EMI said, no, it's worth more to us as a tax write-off.
Right, than as an actual write.
Yeah.
That sucks.
Oh, man, it was devastating.
It's really disgusting when you sit back and you look at somebody's artwork and like if you put it in the context of like a fucking Sistine Chapel or something.
Right,
like,
right.
Yeah, you know, we'd love to finish God touching Adam's hand, but it'd really be better for us to have that as a write-off.
As a write-off.
To not have it.
And this was, know? I mean, and you know, as passionate as we were at the time, it was just like,
ugh.
Wow. And I mean, further down the line, and you know this,
yeah.
you've been around, you know this, like further down the line, it turns out that ours is sort of a success story compared to what happened to some people.
Sure, yeah.
At least we didn't owe them anything,
right,
you know?
Right, right. So then what did you guys do?
So broke up.
Okay.
And
it was easier.
Yeah, it was just easier. It was. It was easier than trying to pick up the pieces and figure it out again, you know? And also, like that, like our Sistine Chapel had been demolished, you know?
Well,
and it was like... Why fucking bother?
Yeah, yeah.
Why bother? And we tried. Hav was the first to defect. Javier left and moved to New York City. And Alejandro and I tried to kind of make the band mutate from the True Believers into something else and keep playing together. And I just felt wrong about it. It seemed like we could call it something else, but people were still expecting
right.
the True Believers thing. And it's just, this is just wrong. It didn't feel right. And so I pulled out and went, although, no, I didn't really pull out. Al and I had a long talk about it, and we both got really mad at each other. And it was like, I moved out to L.A. and got married. And that was like the next phase of my life. Meanwhile, Al stayed here and started engineering his next thing. And, you know, look what happened.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, now it's kind of like the whole business about friction between me and Al, it's kind of a joke.
Right.
You know, because the truth is, for those 5 years that we were in a band together, we were roommates. Like, when we were on the road, he and I always shared a room,
right.
You know, and we shared everything. And we both know where all the bodies are buried.
Yeah.
You know, and I love him like a brother, and I still do. I mean, he's done, you know, my John Dean Friend show twice, and he's going to do it at the end of this month. He really is. He's like one of the people from my past. It's just like, I love him. I love him to death. But yeah, there was, you can't go through something as intense as what we went through and not have weird feelings about it, you know?
So when you moved to LA, did you start like doing a lot more sideman gigs?
Yeah. I lucked out, basically within 6 months of moving there. I met John Doe from the band X,
right.
And ended up writing and recording and touring with him for about 2 years. And that was like a dream come true for me, because X was one of my favorite bands from L.A.
Yeah.
And so getting to play with John, and that was sort of, that was an entry into that side of L.A. And so from there, you know, I played with Michelle Shocks, did like a couple of tours with her, and recorded with X-Scene.
Uh-huh.
And
Michelle Shocked is really nice.
Yeah, she's amazing. And back then, I mean, she had it going on. It was it was really...
You're doing the short, sharp shot.
Yeah, exactly.
That's when you played with her. Wow.
Yeah, and Captain Swing.
Right.
That was the tour that I did, was a Captain Swing. And she was a show woman, man. It was a great time. I mean, real educational. Because I was playing with a horn section, two keyboard players, two drummers. I mean, it was
all pro.
Yeah, big full ass on. Band.
Yeah.
And it's just like acting. I mean, here's your mark, hit it, deliver this line at this time. You know, there was no improvising.
No.
You know, it was very, very tight show.
Wow.
You know? And so anyway, that was all really good for me in terms of, I mean, it was like taking musical vitamins.
Sure.
You know, it built my bones up, you know, and kind of pull me back from the edge of that whole artistic chaos thing that you hit when you're at about 30, you know?
Yeah.
And so it made me have to work harder and to learn that, you know, learn what's expected.
Right.
You know? And also I got that song covered on the Patti Smyth record.
Right.
And got a gold record from that. And the thing is, though, is it's just, L.A. is just a hard place to live.
It's hard,
man.
Yeah.
Good God.
I mean, a lot of driving and just a lot of competition, like almost unnecessary.
Oh!
To the point where it's just like, you just always have to be, like, you know, conversations at the coffee shop. Like,
yeah.
What are you doing? Well, I'm this guy.
Yeah, and you know, coming into that from Austin...
Yeah.
Was a rude fucking awakening, you know, where everybody just sort of, I mean, people talk about Austin being really competitive. It's not. It's just that you have to be this good. It's like, you know, you have to be this tall to ride this ride.
Exactly.
You have to be this good to play in Austin.
Right.
You know, if you're not this good, it's going to look really competitive.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? But it's really, if you make your living or any portion of your living playing in Austin, you get a merit badge, you know,
because you have to be at least as good.
Exactly. You have to be at least as good to ride this ride, you know? And moving out to LA was like being dumped in the shark pool, you know, poison sharks.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I lucked out by hooking up with John when I did, because then I was sort of, you know, came under the protection of that mafia.
Right.
You know? But boy, it was super competitive.
Yeah.
And like, if you got a gig, you did everything you could to hold on to it, because there were five other guys that were not just waiting, they were trying to get your gig.
Yeah.
You know? And it was a crazy time, you know?
So how long did you live there?
Like 7 years.
7 years?
7 years, yeah.
What made you move back?
Well, you know what? I had about year five was when, I mean, one through five was John Doe, Michelle Schacht, all of that. Like, real hard work, you know, like going out constantly in the studio a lot and doing a lot of sideman gigs, a lot of session stuff. And having sort of a hard time at home because I was touring so much, and my wife and I were growing apart, and so I took this gig with Calvin Russell touring in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time he had a number one record in France and Belgium and Switzerland, like all the French speaking countries.
Yeah.
Basically he had this big hit. And so I went to Europe with him on what was supposed to be a 2 month tour, and not unlike Gilligan, you know, ended up spending the rest of that year there. I mean, I was basically just doing big circles of Europe in a tour bus with Calvin. And when I came home, there was nothing left, you know, it was just basically ashes. And so my marriage was gone, and I was just sick of L.A., you know, and pretty much the whole time I lived in L.A., in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, when do I get to go home?
Right.
You know, home being Austin, when do I get to go home? And so that would have been 95, and the December 95, I moved back to Austin. And I was going to quit, you know, I'm not going to play music anymore, I'm done, I'm hanging up my guns. You ever done that?
Yeah.
This week.
Yeah. I've already done it twice this week, and it's only Tuesday.
It's only Tuesday. Yeah, I was going to hang up my guns. I'm not doing this anymore. This is not a career for a grown man. And I started doing construction. I'm a shitty carpenter. Terrible. But I was framing houses and doing remodel work and all of this stuff. And
nothing reminds you how much easier it is to play music than a little construction work.
Right.
Little manual labor for you. Same thing happened to me. I mean, at one point I thought, I'll just go paint houses and just play guitar.
Yeah.
Have a good time and not be angry at everything that I do musically.
Right, right, right.
And man, I loved music after the first day more than I ever had. I was like, I'm going back into it so much. Yeah. So how long did you do that? Not that long.
6 months.
Yeah.
6 months.
And then did you start playing at Continental Club on Wednesdays then?
No, here's not what happened then. was in that 6 months, I ran into Michael Hardwick, who I knew kind of from the old days, but we had never been close or even worked together, you know. But I knew I really liked him. He was like a good guy, a straight-up guy, and a hell of a player. And he said, you know what, I got this session going on, and I really need a second guitar player. Why don't you come in and do it? And I'm like, well, I'm hanging up my guns. I'm not going to play anymore. And he went, it's $500 for one day. And I was like, I'll be there.
Yeah.
Because I needed money so bad.
Yeah, and plus that's like a week of construction.
It's a week of construction at the time. Yes, it was a week of construction. Yeah. And so I went in to do this session, and it was bullshit. The session was terrible. And the best part about it was I got to play with really good players, you know, and hang out with Mike Hardwick. And I was playing in the little lounge area, just playing some song of mine. And Hardwick was like, what's that? I said, well, it's one of my songs. He was like, oh, let me listen to it. So I started playing all these songs that I've been writing, you know, for him. And he was like, well, you need to do something with that. So I started getting together with Mike and playing at his house, just sitting around his dining room table and playing acoustic guitars with a little boom box recording and just working on these songs. And about that same time, I got a call from Kelly Willis. She was looking for a guitar player, and I ended up that then the construction thing was just gone, and I was just touring with Kelly and working on these tapes with Mike Hardwick for no clear reason, you know. And then we started playing at the Continental Club. Really, in the beginning, it was just me and Mike playing acoustic guitars. And then we moved into this Wednesday night and had a whole month. Steve gave me a month of Wednesdays, and so we thought, we need to have a band. And so we got John Paul was playing drums, and George Reef was playing bass. And then John Paul moved out, and JJ moved in. And by the end of the month, it was like, well, this is great. I mean, this is, it was a hell of a band.
Yeah.
You know, it's me and Hardwick and George Reeve and JJ. It was massive, yeah. man. I mean, there's it was, and nobody was coming out to see it. It was a graveyard. Wednesday yeah. night was a graveyard. And Steve was like, I don't have anything else. Why don't y'all just do it again next month? And so we did this thing where we're like, if you're a working musician, you can get in for free.
Right.
If you're a working musician, come yeah. to the back door and you can get in for free. So all of a sudden, Wednesday nights, it was like service industry night right. for musicians, yeah. you know? And it was, I don't remember at the time thinking that that was a particularly fiendishly clever idea
right.
or anything.
No.
But wow.
Yeah, it really worked
like,
out.
In hindsight, yeah. it turned out to be a great thing, yeah. you know, because all the musicians in town were coming out. And then they were like, wow, this is, you know, JJ and George yeah. and Hardwick. They, I mean, yeah. it was a musician's band, you right. know? And so then I was like, it just kind of, now it's, I've been doing it 13 years, you know, 13 yeah. years of every Wednesday night.
I think that's awesome.
It is awesome, you know, and I mean, you know what?
You've been able to do everything, you know, around it.
Absolutely.
And make
absolutely.
Records
and... I mean, I, you know, it, if anything, I think it's like the, I mean, there's some nights it's really packed. Some nights it's not so packed, but it's the one constant in my career where I go out with John Hyatt, you know, and I'm playing for 3,000 people, and I come back and I'm playing for 300 people. Yeah. Or I go out on my own, I'm playing for 30 people, and I come back and I'm playing for 150 people.
Right.
And it's like, we call it the office.
Yeah.
You know, we're going down to the office.
Yeah.
And I got to say, I mean, Steve Wertheimer from the Continental, that's, he's my guy, man.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he gave me a gig when nobody else would, and then he allowed me to build there, and he's protected it.
Yeah.
You know, he's protected it. It's my night. He said, you know, as long as you want to have it, it's your night.
Yeah.
And that in a town like Austin, man, that's something else.
Yeah. Especially you know? In a place that's not going anywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Exactly. I've been playing there since I was 18.
Yeah.
The Skunks played there when I was 18. And now
wow.
at 52, I'm still playing there. And proudly.
Yeah,
you
proudly.
Know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, it's cool.
So you started that residency. And then you made, was your first record, Escape from
yeah.
Monster Island out of that, right?
Out of that. And what happened with that is we played one of those KUT live sets, just me and Hardwick. And Matt Eske from Freedom Records heard it and was like, let me buy that master and put it out. And Hardwick, this was all his doing. Hardwick was like, well, how much would you pay for that master? And he said, well, probably $3,500. And Hardwick said, give us the $3,500 and we'll present you with a band record instead of this live radio, two acoustic guitars.
Right.
Give us that money and we'll make you a real record. And I'm like, there's no way. There's no way we can do this. Because this is before the computer recording
right. yeah,
explosion,
yeah, yeah.
you know. And so we went into... We went into the Hit Shack over on South Lamar
mm-hmm.
and recorded round the clock, day and night, cut it in 3 days, round the clock, mixed it in 2 days, and then delivered it. And to this day, it's still my favorite record.
Yeah.
you know? I mean,
yeah.
it was the one made under the most duress, you know, without us having a methodology or even knowing what we were doing. And
right.
it's still, you know, it's still like my favorite child.
You still,
know?
You, you're, they, he's, Matt Eske still puts out your records.
He does. He does. For when I was on New West for several years.
Right.
Did 4 albums for them. And then the last 2, starting with Full and then It's Not As Bad As It Looks. Just because, you know, with the current state of the fucking music industry, what does it mean to have a label, you know?
I don't know.
Nothing.
Yeah, I don't know. It's
yeah,
weird.
It doesn't mean anything. And
well,
so
someone has money you don't have.
Right, it's right.
That's the only thing, but no one really does.
No, no. And the other thing, too, is, you know, when you do that, and I had to learn this the hard way, but you're borrowing your own money.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. You're borrowing money from yourself, and it might take you longer than you think to pay it back.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, and plus, you know, Matt is just, he's just a hell of a guy in terms of, gives me complete control over what I'm doing, you know, structures the deals that we both make money, and, you know, in a modest way, but in the current climate, you know,
a modest way
yeah, is
good.
Something.
Yeah, it is something.
Know? I mean, if you get paid for your music at all,
yeah,
that's
something. Good. Yeah.
You know?
So what did you guys do for that record? Were you able to tour behind it, or did you just play regionally and locally? And
it's funny because we started off just doing regional and local, and this guy from Arlington, Virginia, Steve Negri, who owns a club called the Iota.
Yeah.
Somebody had given him a copy of Escape, and he fell in love with it. And in the old days of phone books and stuff,
right,
he looked me up and found me and was like, "Are you the same guy who made this record?" And I'm like,
yeah.
Yeah. And he said, "I want you to come play my club. I own this club up in Arlington. If you ever come up here, I want you to come play it." And so we built a tour around going to play the Iota.
Yeah.
And I mean, I just played the Iota about 4 months ago. You know, I still play there now. And
that's the place that has kind of the pole that awkwardly
blocks right
the
stage. Middle.
Yeah, right in the middle.
Yeah. And then they have a little half wall.
Yeah.
Where it's like you can talk to the people on this side or on this side,
right,
but you can't do it both, or otherwise you're cross-eyed. And you know, my touring has gone up and down and up and down, and really,
which is normal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you know what? It's pretty much today still what it was back then, which is, you know, I do super well in Chicago. I do really well in D.C. I do really well in Kansas City. I do pretty good in San Francisco. I do really good in Seattle. I do great in New York City.
Right.
And then past that, it's just a lot of rolling the dice, you know?
Sometimes certain shows will be good. And,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And you never know, you know? I mean, it turns out I'm really big in Sioux City. I had no idea.
I didn't realize that either.
Yeah. And we played Sioux City for the first time last year. And packed and how no idea how but the so traditionally the Midwest is my breadbasket,
right,
you know, but like I said, Seattle I do well, San Francisco, New York City is always great, so you know, it's pretty much that's the shape of it.
It's good. So then you came back after that and started working on your next record.
On the next
record, Hooray for the Moon, or that came later?
no that would be Summerland.
Okay.
And then I was approached by New West Records, and at the time...
But at the time, you were getting, like, you know, these records were critically acclaimed.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
I mean,
being really brilliant records.
Yeah, we actually got... We were making year-end lists, you know, for everything that we did. And so we were approached by New West, which at that time, New West was just Billy Joe Shaver and Stephen Bruton.
Right.
You know, Cameron Strang running that label. And he managed to bring Sony in. And so they turned into like one of the first really boutique labels, you know, major label, boutique label.
Right.
And they signed me up, and I did, how many records for them? I did Summerland, The Great Battle. No, Summerland, Hooray for the Moon, and The Great Battle. So three records for them. And they went back and bought Escape for Matt to consolidate the catalog. And it was a good thing to be on that label. I think we kind of outgrew each other, you know, and the parting, as always, was really acrimonious, you know.
Right.
But we've sorted everything out now.
You know?
In fact, it's funny because I just got a statement from New West 2 weeks ago, and I finally recouped.
Good.
No, I mean, for four records, for to recoup their, you know, their outlay, that's a big thing.
Yeah.
You know, so I think we're all pretty happy.
I think the only record
now.
I've ever recouped on, honestly, is the one I made at my house.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of the case here, you know.
So, the resentments, when did you start doing that?
Oh, man. You know what? That's kind of foggy. I think I would have to research it because I honestly don't know.
Were
I
they
think
playing
was,
or did you, how did you, how
no,
did you fall into that group?
That was, I knew Stephen Bruton.
Right.
And so, okay, you know what? It would have been about 96, like the end of 96.
Right, yeah, the band's been around for
yeah,
a while.
About 96, early 97. Bruton, the original Resentments was myself, Bruton, Hal Ketchum.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and Keith Carper playing bass. Hal Ketchum was playing drums and singing. And it started off as a joke. It was the Saxon Pub was dark on Sundays, and so we asked him to open and just do an early night songwriter thing. And it was basically just something for all of us to do on Sunday nights. And it was just so much fun that we kept doing it. And because Stephen Bruton, you know, rest in peace, was knew everybody in the world. Whenever somebody would come to town, they would come sit in with us. And so after we had Bonnie Raitt and Al Anderson and Kris Kristofferson come and sit in with us, Then it became like a big deal.
Yeah.
And so it turned into this sold out thing on Sunday nights. And we made a live record. And
there.
And somehow it made its way into the Germans' hands, into Blue Rose Records. They put it out, and all of a sudden, we were touring in Europe and playing really big houses in Europe. We only played two places in the world, you know, the Saxon Pub and Europe.
Yeah.
and it was very funny to all of us, but it was like, in spite of ourselves, it was a successful band,
right.
You know? And it was very much on everybody's back burner.
Right.
It was just a thing that we did on Sunday nights, but once a year we would go to Europe for like a month and a half and go get paid and come back, you know?
That's great.
And then Mambo, John Traynor, who's the original drummer,
right?
He passed away, and John Chipman joined, and then up to that point, we'd just been passing the bass around, taking turns playing bass.
Yeah, I saw you guys do that a few times.
And so then we added Bruce Hughes, and then at one point, God, what's his name? David Holt from Storyville was a guitar player, and he left to go tour with Carlene Carter, and Scrappy came on board, and that's kind of some version. I think I left after Stephen died. And Stephen Bruton died 2 years ago, and it just didn't feel right to me to stay there. They're still going,
though.
I think Miles Zuniga is in the band
now. It's like Miles and Bruce and Scrappy. And
Plankenhorn, I heard.
Yeah,
I haven't seen it, but God bless them, you know. It's a cool deal, and it was never really about who was in it anyway. It's just sort of this rotating thing, you know.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm really... It warms my heart that it still goes on.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Let me ask you about, you did your solo albums, and at that time you did The Resentments, and then there's a documentary that's out about you. We talked a little bit about that, which I'm going to buy when I get home. I was bummed out I couldn't just download it from somewhere and watch it before I came in. But tell me about that. That's out there. What's the name of it? I'm sorry.
It's called Swept Away.
Swept Away.
And it's just this guy who's now actually a really good friend of mine. We're really close, but at the time he was a film producer from the Bravo Channel, Bravo Network, and he got in contact with me and was like, I would like to do a short documentary on you, focusing on this sort of, you know, traveling musician, you know, the struggling musician. And I think it was originally intended to be a series of things that he was doing, and we met and he sort of hung out with me for a while, and then he was like, well, I'm just gonna do a whole film on this. And it's hard to watch a film about yourself. So, but he was around for some really sort of amazing shows and some amazing events. And it's nice to have that stuff documented.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, it still sells. I mean, it's on the internet in several places, and they've run segments of it on Bravo.
That's good.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And you get any recognition out of that? Like you get emails every once in a while, hey, I heard you're, you know.
Yeah.
That's
good. I get people contact me, that being the first place they've come in contact with it.
Right.
So. And you know, it's nice to have that captured. So, you know, I mean, I don't think in these terms, but you know, for posterity, it's like, you know, to have my grandkids at some point be able to see what it was I was doing.
Yeah.
You know,
that's good.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Yeah. And so, and during that time, you've also produced records and done other things. You did a record with Casey Crowley.
Yeah.
Which is one of my favorite of hers.
That's an amazing record. It had nothing to do with me. That was Casey and her band at the time, which was just amazing.
Yeah.
That song, Kind of Perfect. To me, that's like one of the best captures of anything Casey's done.
Yeah.
And again, it had nothing to do with me. All I did was say, press the button, But yeah, what I've discovered over time, because I've produced a few different records.
Who all have you produced?
Steve Wiedermeyer from Houston, just demos for various people, and I'm just not very good at it. You know, I don't have the attention span I think that it takes to do that.
Yeah.
I don't have the focus, and also, I mean, you know what it's like to be a songwriter and to have really specific ideas about how things need to sound.
Right.
And it may or may not jive with what the artist wants,
right.
You know? And so what I like to do is consult, you know, like people will ask me their opinion, ask me my opinion about some demos or what would you do with this? And I could do that all day, you know? I'd much rather do that than have the reins, you know? I like playing on other people's stuff. I love that. And I've gotten to do, you know, some pretty interesting sessions over the years. I prefer that to being on the other side of the glass, you know?
Right. On Casey's record that you played though too.
Yeah, I did. I played on that. And I mean, it's funny because somebody was asking me about a record that I did a session for, and I couldn't remember where it was or when it was. And I went on the All Music Guide and I was stunned.
How much stuff you had done?
How much stuff I'd done. I never really paid much attention to it because, you know.
Yeah, you're always thinking.
Yeah, what's next? What's next?
Yeah.
What's next? And I've got like 60-something album credits
on
All Music Guide.
That's a lot.
It's a lot, you know. And many of them I didn't even remember.
Yeah.
I'd be going down and go, oh, fuck, Simon Bonney? You know, the Australian guy that was part of the whole Nick Cave thing. I forgot. I'd played on Mick Harvey and Simon Bonney's record when I lived in L.A.
Wow.
You know, a million little things that I never thought about, you know.
Yeah.
I did them and I moved on. But it's like, 60-plus album credits.
Wow.
Who would have thought?
I don't know. But you're doing something right now with Freddie Johnston and Susan Calso.
Yeah. The Hobart Brothers featuring Little Sis Hobart.
Is that?
It's... we all three met at South By before last, like 2 years ago. And in all of our talks, Freddie was one of my heroes, one of my songwriting heroes. That album, Can You Fly, I think is one of the most perfect songwriting albums of all time. That song, Mortician's Daughter, or even the song, Can You Fly, it's unreal, unreal. And so I was really excited to meet him and ended up playing in his band for a while when he lived in Austin for about 6 months. And I played lap steel in his band. And he introduced me to Sue Castle, who was like an icon, you know, in the days when I was growing up around PBS. And we're doing a record together that is all co-written songs. Each of us sings, like each of us has three songs that we sing on it. And then one song that we all sing together. And that comes out in January, late January.
Are you guys going to be able to do some touring and stuff?
That's the plan.
You guys or something?
Yeah, that's the plan. Actually, Sue, the drummer on it is Sue Cowsill's husband, Russ Broussard. And so we would probably go out with Russ and take Andrew Duplantis because he plays on the record.
Okay.
And, you know, they... they're booking the tour now, and it would begin beginning of February, and we're getting great response.
Good.
You know, people are making bids on it, and
awesome.
I mean, I think because between Freedy's audience, which is different from my audience, and Sue's audience, which is different from both of our audiences, together, it's one of those things where 1 + 1 + 1 =
yeah.
7, you
yeah.
know?
And I mean, if all the audiences groove on what you guys are doing,
oh,
it's, it can
yeah.
be big.
It's huge. Yeah. yeah. So I'm really excited about that.
That's great. What else are you working on?
I'm doing the co-op, which we talked about
right.
a little bit
yeah,
before.
Yeah. Explain this.
Essentially, it's a subscription service where once a month you get exclusively a new song that I write and record, a new song every month. And you get a piece of artwork, and you get short clips of performances. The Johnny and Friend show, which you've mm-hmm. done with me, and
yep.
you're going to come back and do
yep.
another one in November.
Yeah.
And we run clips of that. We run clips of live performances. So on the first of every month, you receive a downloadable song and a downloadable scan of an artwork. And then the 15th, you get performance clips. And we're about 150 strong right now.
Nice.
And it's great. In fact, I sent you some of the stuff. You can check out the artwork.
Right.
But the two
yeah,
songs
yeah.
that I sent you and this third one that I brought for you over here, it's all the offerings that we've had since we started up in September.
Excellent. So that's
yeah.
when you got it going, was in September.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So it's pretty recent.
Oh, yeah. 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 And you can check it out. There's the manifesto, which is if you go to johndgraham.com.
Yeah, there you go.
It just comes up.
Okay. So go to johndgraham.com.
Read the manifesto and join our movement.
You're still doing Wednesdays.
Absolutely. And I do Sunday nights, which is the Johnny and Friends
yeah,
show.
Every Sunday in the gallery, Continental
just
Club.
Just sort of like the musical Dick Cavett thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I enjoyed doing it. It was
it's
like
fun
this,
as
but
hell.
With music.
Yeah, like this, yeah. only we had guitars.
We had guitars. We could defer to from time to time.
Right. This is fun. Thanks for asking me.
You're welcome, man.
This.
I've always liked you, and I remember when I first met you, it was kind of the late 90s when my band was in the process of getting signed and doing this whole
oh,
thing.
Yeah,
and I used to
yeah,
see you
yeah.
all the time at Flipnotics, and we
yeah.
would always talk, and there was always this great sort of like grounding conversation because you come from these like, oh, how are we going to do this and do this and do this, and you'd be like, you know, like definitely like a grain of salt guy, like
yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Well, you know, that could be great
or not.
It could kill you.
either way.
Yeah, yeah. But I've always appreciated you and your sense of humor, and you're a really warm guy.
Thanks,
and
man.
You always seem very I appreciate someone with tenacity that stays doing what we do, artist. Just I'm glad you didn't build my house or something.
You know, that it's funny because that's the only real advice that I have for the younger musicians, period, is if you intend to actually do anything, just don't quit.
Yeah.
You know, because that's kind of the secret, you know.
That is the secret.
That's the secret is tenacity.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, it's not like I read somewhere you're talking about you don't fit like the rock star, you know.
Right.
Thing or whatever.
Right.
But really, like, To continue to be able to achieve successes and keep on crossing boundaries, you know, as you go through your career, no matter
yeah.
if you're in your 40s, 30s, 20s, 50s,
whatever,
you know, we're around a lot of people that still do it. And I'm glad that we still do. I'm glad you were my guest.
Hell yeah. Thanks for having me.
And I'll be at your show in November.
Excellent.
Everyone go see John D on Wednesdays at the Continental Club and Sunday nights with a friend at the Continental Club Gallery. All right, more John D. Graham music.
God's crippled little birds. It was a place to talk things over for people without words. Oh, man.
So I think that went well. It was John D. Graham. I'm still outside. Like, I was outside while that whole thing was playing. It was great. It was great to have John D. over. He's always been a really nice guy. We have a good week coming up. I think I'm interviewing Kathy Valentine on Thursday. Right now I say I think because sometimes these things fall through. just simply because someone has to do something else. I'm walking around outside, and not only did I buy ice cream in the first part of the podcast, but I am now, like, in the company of chickens. Hello, chickens. You hear them? Can you hear them going, bark, 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 bark. Hello, chickens. It's like a furry chicken. What a weird thing. It's like a furry chicken wearing a mask. And I don't think this furry chicken wearing a mask likes me. Anyway, thank you for listening. Thanks for episode 17. Thanks for downloading to everyone. You guys are all great. And again, thank you for all the kind words on the 48 hours episode. That was very flattering and really nice of you. Here's some more John D. Graham music, and we'll hear from you at episode 18, won't we? Bye.
Out on the roof, everyone escapes the day. The shirtless bars are playing cards. The swimsuit girls, they look away. Breath.